This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on August 13th. In an online commentary published by Fortune on July 4th of this year, journalist Joe Matthews argues, quote, "The U.S. Constitution needs an overhaul. Here's how California can help," end quote. In building his argument, Matthew notes, quote, "California is a modern democracy with a powerful initiative process that allows its highly diverse population to amend its constitution directly. The U.S., in contrast, is a majority white country that clings to a 1789 constitution that permitted slavery, is nearly impossible to amend, and prohibits election of the president by popular vote," end quote. He goes on further, reminding us of other questionable and outdated concepts built into the U.S. Constitution. Quote, "The power of the U.S. presidency is largely unaccountable. One person in the Oval Office can start nuclear war without anyone else's permission. Other branches are also sheltered from democratic interventions. Too much power lies with a U.S. Senate that gives California's 40 million people the same two senators as Vermont's 625,000. Difficult controversies are decided by a Supreme Court of highly politicized, life-tenured judges," end quote. Matthews puts forth this argument in the first place because he deems the current climate an auspicious time to reimagine such unprecedented changes. But he also recognizes these prospects will enrage those, quote, "Americans who deify their Constitution and assume, wrongly, that the end of our current Constitution would mean the end of freedom and democracy," end quote. Matthews justifies what some will see as radical proposals by stating, quote, "Ending one republic does not mean the end of a nation. It means starting a new republic. The French are on their fifth republic. A new constitution offers the opportunity to refound the United States under present-day ideals of human rights and justice," end quote.
Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm Michelle Manning Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside regular host Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Sanford Levinson. Professor Levinson has been a professor in both the School of Law and the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin for almost 40 years. He has authored, edited, and co-written numerous books, articles, and journals over the course of his extensive career as an accomplished scholar of the U.S. government and its Constitution. Welcome to the program, Professor Levinson.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Why don't we just start off by having you give us a brief introduction on your background and how you came to be the constitutional scholar and law professor you are today?
Well, I got my PhD from Harvard in the 1960s. And wrote a dissertation on Justices Holmes and Frankfurter, taught at Ohio State for a couple of years, became thoroughly disillusioned with the American university at that point, and thought that I would do something useful by becoming a lawyer. And the aspiration or the fantasy was to become a civil rights lawyer. So I went to Stanford. I graduated from Stanford in 73. Clerked for a federal judge in North Carolina who had written the leading decision on busing in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then I worked for a year with Marion Wright Edelman at the Children's Defense Fund, and then could not resist the temptation to go back into teaching. I taught at Princeton for 4 years and then came here in 1980. And have been teaching constitutional law since then, focusing really on the history of American constitutional law, though in recent years, I've become at least as much interested in comparative law and in constitutional design. But design issues really are almost never brought before the U.S. Supreme Court, and therefore most lawyers and most citizens tend to be much too ignorant of the importance of design issues than I think they ought to be.
Interesting. I think that's what I was getting at as far as wanting to have you on the show and talk to you about your expertise. My interest was piqued in your body of work when I heard an interview you gave a few months back, which mirrored many of the same arguments set forth in the Matthews commentary that I quoted in the introduction to the program. Mm-hmm. And in particular, two of your many published works, I noticed, are Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong, and How We the People Can Correct It, which was published in 2006, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance, which was published in 2012, examine these premises in depth. Basically, that in order for America to truly live up to its democratic ideals and fix much of the political dysfunction we find ourselves in now, we need to make major fundamental changes to our Constitution. So where do you start this conversation when someone asks you what you actually mean by that?
Right. Let me add one more book that my wife and I co-authored, though she really was the primary author. She's a prize-winning writer of books for children and young adults, and this book is targeted basically toward a teenage audience, but I always emphasize that I hope the grandparents, parents, and everybody else will pick it up and read it as well. It's called Fault Lines in the Constitution, and I mention it in part because it was published in a second edition just last year, that is 2019. And one of the things that is true about the Trump administration is that it has, in a way, been like an MRI in terms of revealing some of the real problems with the Constitution that I wrote about earlier. But frankly, 2006 and 2012 right now seem eons ago, and not merely just 8 years ago or 14 years ago. So it's hard to know where to start, but just thinking of the Trump administration, let me focus on three. First of all, there was the decision in 1787 to have a presidential form of government. That made a lot of sense in 1787, in part because what we today know as parliamentary systems were just barely on the horizon. That was the case in Great Britain, but still at that point, it was more on the horizon than the kind of reality that it is today in the UK and in most countries around the world. My own view is that presidentialism, whatever sense it might have made 230 years ago, does not serve us well today, for a variety of reasons. I think it promotes a kind of Caesarism in political leadership. We focus way too much on the particular individual who becomes president. We have created a bloated presidency with tremendous powers. Most of what Donald Trump is doing is thoroughly legal because he's been delegated the power by Congress for a variety of reasons. And then there's a real problem that we can't get rid of a president in whom we have justifiably lost confidence, except by waiting 4 years for the next election. In a parliamentary system, you can fire a prime minister at any moment if he or she loses the confidence of majority of parliament. We can't do that. It's also the case that impeachment just does not work. Anybody who had any doubts about that should certainly have lost any of those doubts in the fiasco that took place in February. And so if we had the new constitutional convention that I very much want, then I would want one of the central issues to be, A, should we continue with the presidency at all? B, if we decide for whatever reason the answer is yes, should it be the kind of presidency we have? Should, for example, there be some mechanism for either a vote of no confidence, forget the impeachment clause, which has been captured by lawyers, and that's a disaster. A vote of no confidence would leave lawyers out of the discussion. Lawyers would have nothing useful to say, and the discussion would be about what's really important. That is, do you have confidence in this particular individual to make decisions that are literally of life and death importance. And those are the two principal changes. We might also talk about the length of the term. There's much to be said for a single six-year term that would prevent presidents from running for re-election literally the moment they win the first time. They spend a disgraceful amount of their time campaigning and raising funds. But then the very last thing I will say is that one of the reasons this discussion sounds just crazy is because Article 5 of the Constitution, the amendment provision, makes it next to impossible to amend the Constitution. So almost any proposals for constitutional change sound literally fantastic. That is, they can't occur. You've got to be quite up in years to remember the last time that an amendment was proposed to the U.S. Constitution. The answer was 1972, and it was the Equal Rights Amendment. There are lots of proposals for amending the Constitution, but most of them are made kind of as red meat thrown to the base. There are not serious discussions about constitutional reform because it's viewed as next to impossible, which it may be. And that, I think, is the worst single feature of the Constitution.
Yeah, so that, I guess, raises the question, where do you see the hope of being able to go forward with any kind of change to it? Is there something that we're missing, or is there some glimmer of hope here?
Yeah, there's a glimmer, but I'm not sure there's more than that. Both my book, Framed, and the book that Cynthia and I wrote on Fault Lines of the Constitution, one of the things that both books do is to focus on American state constitutions as well as the national constitution and point out that in many, many states, there are alternative ways of amending the constitution. The most obvious one is through initiative and referendum. We don't have that in Texas, but about 20 or 25 American states do have procedures whereby you can do end runs around the legislature and we the people can speak directly. The most obvious, and depending on your point of view, either famous or infamous example is California, but there are lots of other states that we consider to be safe and sane and sober that also have procedures for direct democracy. Or some states, like, for example, Wisconsin and California, have procedures for recall of governors. The legislature can't vote a governor out of office, but in California in 2003 or so, the voters of California voted Gray Davis out of office. And in 2012 or 11, there was a serious attempt to vote Scott Walker out of office in Wisconsin. It failed, but there was still an election about him. So the real problem, frankly, is that the 1787 framers were extraordinarily suspicious of democracy. And even though they talked in the language of we the people, they completely locked out the people from any direct role in governing. As I say, if you look at the American states, that's just not true. But this is a problem not only with the 1787 Constitution, but the fact that we have an exaggerated veneration for the 1787 Constitution and won't learn from the fact that most American states whose constitutions were written well after 1787 have rejected some very important aspects of the U.S. Constitution.
So it sounds to me like basically the states are going to play the pivotal role at this point if we want to see any kind of changes, because we're kind of locked into it based on the Constitution itself.
Yeah, possibly. There is an attempt by right-wing forces. No, very few people on the left support it, but there is a vigorous attempt, supported for that matter by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, to use one provision of Article 5, the amendment article, that would force Congress to call a new constitutional convention if two-thirds of the states petition for a new constitutional convention. And say Greg Abbott proposed a series of changes in the Constitution that he called the Texas Plan several years ago, and actually supported a new constitutional convention. Somewhere, I think, 25 to 30 states of the 34 necessary have endorsed that, but I don't think they're going to get to the magic number of 34, partly because it is viewed as a right-wing attempt to amend the Constitution. I am very disappointed that most people who identify themselves with the left have decided that the right strategy vis-a-vis this right-wing attempt to call a new constitutional convention is to attack the very idea of a new constitutional convention around our so-called wonderful Constitution, rather than to say, yeah, we do need a new constitutional convention. Let's talk about the changes that we want and have a long overdue real argument.
It just seems to me that we're in such a highly politicized environment right now. I mean, I think about a modest change for the way we do things would be the Electoral College. Just get rid of that and go to strictly a popular vote. But the party that's in power right now is not going to sit for that. That's how they got in.
You know, you're probably right. But let me suggest that one important difference between structural issues, that is, basic mechanisms of government, rather than the rights provisions of the Constitution, that is what we teach about in law schools, what most people think about when they think about the Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, abortion, guns, etc. If, I mean, take the Electoral College or take some of these other things that I'm talking about. I firmly believe that if we got Greg Abbott and Lloyd Doggett in a room and said, okay, how should the country be governed in 2028 when no rational person can express any real confidence as to who's going to be president or what American politics really look like? So, in 2028, the Electoral College, it is really not clear at all which political party benefits from the Electoral College. You can make arguments, obviously, given what happened in 2000 and 2016, that it worked to the Republicans' benefit. But in 2004, John Kerry would have become president had he gotten 70,000 more votes in Ohio, even though George W. Bush got about 3 million more votes nationwide. It would have been the mirror image of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So it's, say, not at all clear who benefits. I think if we were talking about 2028, there might still be difference of opinion on the Electoral College, but I don't think we'd be shouting at one another. I think we could sit down and really ask, is this the best way to elect a president? If Texas becomes purple, then we're going to see presidential candidates. But one of the things that is true in the era of Republican dominance is that no presidential candidates bother to spend any time in Texas except raising money. No presidential candidate spends any real time about the problems that are facing Texans, because Republicans since 1984 or 1980, forget the last time Democrats carried Texas, frankly, but Republicans obviously take Texas for granted, and Democrats see no reason to spend any time in Texas. So I can imagine the Republican Greg Abbott saying, you know, in 2028, it might be a good thing if both candidates for president had to campaign in Texas. And the best way to ensure that they would campaign in Texas is to get rid of the Electoral College. The presidential veto, I think it is way, way too hard to override a presidential veto. It turns us into a tricameral system and not simply a bicameral system of the House and the Senate. There are lots of different ways of running veto systems. If you look at the American states, maybe presidents should still have vetoes, but the veto should be overridable by a 55% vote or an absolute majority. That is not merely majority of those who vote, but a majority of the entire 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate. I don't think Democrats and Republicans would be at each other's throats. That Democratic presidents cast vetoes that block Republican programs, Republican presidents block vetoes that block Democratic presidents. So we could really have a calm discussion of how much power we want to put in the hands of the president as against the legislature. And life tenure for members of the Supreme Court. I don't think that Republicans are very glad that Ruth Ginsburg hangs on at the age of 85 or 86, or that John Paul Stevens hung on till he was 90. Democrats would obviously love to get rid of some of the Republican justices who stay forever. So again, if we stop talking about the justices who are on the court right now and talk about justices appointed, 8 years from now, I think there would be almost unanimous agreement that life tenure is a dumb idea in the 21st century. So as polarized as we are, I think that the kinds of concerns that I have primarily do not necessarily divide us in the same way that, to take the most obvious example, our concerns about abortion divide us. It wouldn't matter. I mean, if we said, okay, let's talk about an abortion law should be 8 years from now instead of tomorrow, nobody's mind would change. Those sorts of issues we're going to be shouting at one another about until God knows when. But we don't have to shout at each other about the structural issues, especially if we are able to get beyond literally next week and think of the fact that, going back to the Electoral College, we've had this crazy method of electing presidents now for 230 years. It generated civil war once in 1860. It almost generated civil war in 1800. And it has had very dubious effects on the actual conduct of elections. So I don't think we're really polarized necessarily about whether the Electoral College is a good idea. Every single poll taken since 1944 has shown that a majority of Americans want to get rid of the Electoral College. And frankly, until very, very recently, and it's all because of the 2016 election, Republicans were just about as likely to oppose the Electoral College as Democrats are. My hunch is that if and when Joe Biden wins in November, then Republicans are going to revert to their typical position of being 60 to 70% opposed to the Electoral College in the same way that Democrats have been 60 to 70% opposed to the Electoral College.
Well, one down, huh?
Given that, since we are talking in terms of these questions a lot with the current climate, are you hopeful that the current climate, as it's been changed in the last couple of months with all the protests and everything, might move us forward in some of these conversations, getting us to a place where we really need to be, like you're talking about?
Well, I want to say yes and no. If Joe Biden wins, and if the Democrats win the Senate, and if on literally day one of the Senate session in 2021, they get rid of the filibuster, and if there might even be talk of what some people would regard as court packing in order to make sure that the majority of right-wing Republican judges won't stand in the way of legislation passed by a Democratic House and Senate without a filibuster, then, yeah, I could have real hope. But all of those things have to happen. If Joe Biden wins and Mitch McConnell remains majority leader, or if the Democrats take the Senate, but they don't have the backbone to get rid of the filibuster, then frankly, I think we're close to doomed. I would much, much prefer a Biden presidency to a Trump presidency, which I think would be an unmitigated disaster. But part of the problem I have with our political system is that we overfocus on who is president and underfocus on the overall system. And the paradox is that if Joe Biden doesn't have a very cooperative Congress that indeed is pushing him in certain directions that he might not naturally want to go, then we're going to measure progress by and large by Biden's willingness to take complete advantage in the way that Donald Trump has of the legal powers of the presidency. And you're suddenly going to find a lot of Democrats defending aggressive presidential power. And Republicans are going to start saying, does he think he's king? And we will continue shouting at one another about presidential excess. But the difference would be that this time it would presumably be our president, if we're Democrats, who are behaving excessively. The way Barack Obama did. I mean, I support DACA. I'm very glad that he did what he did, but I can fully understand why principled constitutionalists would be at least a bit bothered by the fact that after saying for a couple of years, look, I'm not king. I can't do this. Congress has to do this. He then decided, because Congress was completely, utterly irresponsible and incapable of acting, he decided that he did have some rather extraordinary powers after all. And as I say, I support the cause, but we ought to recognize it was a real stretch about presidential power.
It's just dragged the issue on and on. We actually, this past week, did a show on DACA. And as much as people were relieved about the court decision, it didn't solve anything. Basically, it was a decision about procedures. I think Roberts was warning people, like, you better get your act together here because I'm not going to do this again. That was kind of what I read into it anyway.
That's absolutely right. The court kicked the can down the road. And if, God forbid, Donald Trump wins a new term, then he will read the Supreme Court decision, or his lawyers will read the Supreme Court decision, and figure out how to do it right the next time. The fact is, we should all be grateful for the fact that Donald Trump is stunningly incompetent, as well as, I believe, quite malevolent.
We're speaking with Sanford Levinson, a professor in both the School of Law and the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning Scott, along with regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was home-crafted and recorded on August 13th. We're speaking with noted U.S. government and constitutional scholar Sanford Levinson. He is a professor in both the School of Law and the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin.
I did want to have you talk about one of the points you made in the interview that I listened to about the U.S. Senate and your ideas for that particular element of change and what needs to be done there.
There again, it's very difficult to be optimistic. James Madison, in 1787, described the United States Senate as a lesser evil. And I want to focus on both of the words. First of all, it was evil. And what was evil about it? Because it gave Delaware the same number of senators as Virginia. In 1787, Delaware was the smallest state. Virginia was certainly one of the largest states, particularly if you include enslaved persons. And Madison, although he's called the father of the Constitution, was, like many fathers, tremendously disappointed in his child because he lost several of the biggest fights that he engaged in Philadelphia. And one of them was over how many senators states would get. He thought it should be like the House, that is proportional. Virginia should, of course, get more senators than Delaware. But he lost, and he never defended it on principle. What he did say, and this is why it was a lesser evil, is that that was the price that the large states had to pay in order to have a constitution at all. He described Delaware as having engaged in extortion, but there are times where you have to pay the extortioner, and this is one of those times. And so Madison forked over the principle of proportional representation in the Senate in order to get the Constitution. The very same thing was done with regard to slavery, incidentally. The so-called three-fifths clause, whereby Virginia got enhanced representation in the House of Representatives and therefore enhanced power in the Electoral College, because enslaved persons were counted, even though obviously they didn't vote and no plausible argument could be made that the so-called owners of enslaved persons were taking their interests into account when casting their ballots. So from my perspective, the Senate is no more legitimate than slavery, though you can't explain how we get a U.S. Constitution without recognizing that compromises had to be made, that if you don't like these compromises, then what you're saying in effect is that you would have preferred there be no constitution at all, and that there would have been 2 to 3 independent countries along the Atlantic who almost certainly would have gotten into war with one another. If you read The Federalist, what you really discover is the war drums beating in the background if the United States does not unify behind a much, much stronger national government than was the case prior to 1787. And Madison certainly believed that. The problem with the Senate is not only that I think it was unjustifiable, except in terms of paying extortion. It's also the case that Article 5 makes it as a practical matter impossible to modify, because although Article 5 generally allows us to amend the Constitution however we wish, though it's very difficult to do so, Article 5 also says, but wait a minute, there are 2 things that are basically protected against amendment. The first was the international slave trade, which could not be abolished until 1808, period. So it got 20 years of protection. That was also a piece of extortion that was thought necessary to pay in order to get the Constitution. The other thing is the U.S. Senate, because what Article 5 says is basically that every single state would have to consent before the allocation of voting power in the Senate can be changed. All other amendments require, and I want to put scare quotes around the term only, but only 3/4 of the states have to consent. And we have had some amendments, and some amendments were approved only by the minimum of 3/4 of the states. That's true of the Women's Suffrage Amendment that we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of this year, and it got the 38th vote by literally one vote in one of the Tennessee houses because a legislature said his mother had told him basically not to come home if he did not support women's suffrage. So he passed his vote. But it was touch and go about women's suffrage, but it did get through. Whereas nobody imagines that a constitutional amendment changing the allocation of power in the Senate would get through because the Dakotas or Wyoming would veto it. At this point, one has to engage not merely in a fantasy about a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment, but you really have to imagine a national movement in which, for example, the states of what I sometimes call Pacifica, that is California, Oregon, and Washington, would simply say, we're going to leave, that the Senate in particular is so biased in favor of small, rural, white, religious states that the Senate is just a death sentence for the kinds of legislation that states like California, or if truth be known, like Texas, are going to need. What would happen if some of the large states said, we want to leave? I have no idea. And I will also admit that this sounds even more fantastic than the possibility of a constitutional convention or a constitutional amendment. But I do think that's the only way one would generate any genuine discussion of the Senate if it became a real threat to the maintenance of the union and people really had to address why is it that the residents of the Dakotas or Wyoming or Vermont, you know, some Democratic states as well as Republican states, have such grotesquely inordinate power in the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, that was what I was getting at. It's just, I don't think that the American citizenry as a whole recognizes that argument to a large extent, and we just kind of let it slide.
One of the reasons they don't recognize it is because nobody who is regarded as a political leader or as an opinion leader, a pundit, for example, is willing to raise this issue because it appears to be completely and utterly utopian. Bernie Sanders described himself over two campaigns now as a revolutionary, talking about how the system is rigged. But he has benefited from the rigged system. There is no justification for Vermont having the same voting power as Texas. But it would have been astounding if the so-called revolutionary Sanders had said, and you know, the first thing we ought to address in unrigging the system is why in the world the 600,000 or so people in Vermont have the same voting power as the 28 million people in Texas. He didn't do it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's on point. My point is like, nobody's raising that issue. Where's the representation equality in this whole country? It's ideas like yours that need to be spread so that we as a citizenry can be awoken, so to speak, to the greater conflict at issue right now. Civic education is just very poor in this country, so that we as citizens who vote and are supposed to be deciding these things don't understand it well enough to raise a ruckus.
I couldn't agree with you more, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Do you have any closing thoughts about next steps or hope for the future?
Yeah, the next step is pretty much self-evident in November.
Right.
And if that step isn't taken, I really do think we're doomed. But I also would reiterate that we're kidding ourselves if we think that the celebrations on November 4th, or whenever we find out the result of the election, will last more than several days, depending, first of all, on what Congress looks like, and as I say, the willingness of Democrats to get rid of the filibuster, not to mention the fact that, you know, we are a divided country, and there are people of good faith on both sides of many, even if not all of the issues. And the Democratic Party is not a single unified monolith. And there will be, even in a filibuster-free Congress, there will be genuine and deep debates where so-called progressives or leftists or democratic socialists will be on different sides from more moderate members of the House and Senate elected, for that matter, you know, in some of the smaller, less urban states. And one doesn't really know whether we have a political system that is capable of responding to the challenges we face. When we finish talking today, I'm going back to something that's on my computer right now that I've been working on. George Kennan, very famous foreign policy theorist of the late 20th century, wrote in his final memoir that he thought the country was just too big. 320 million people are just too large. We're too diverse. We're too spread out to be effectively governed by a single government. And so he really wanted to break up the United States into 12 separate countries, basically, which is also either crazy or utopian, depending on your point of view. I do think that people who live in Maine have very different perspectives from people who live in Hawaii, even if both of them vote Democratic. And you can just march through different parts of the United States. Or, you know, for that matter, Texas is not a red or a blue or a purple state. It's a blue state in the cities, a red state in West Texas, say, and purple kind of in between. Texas itself is as polarized as the country at large. This is reflected in the very bitter politics within Texas. It will be reflected in the very bitter politics of the United States that will continue whoever wins in 2020. I wish I could be more optimistic, but it's a bit hard right now. So on that note, you know, I'll go back to writing about secession.
Well, it's been a very enlightening conversation for me. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Right. Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed my time with Co-op.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, August 14th. And once again, we've got our friend Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing today, Austin?
I am doing all right. Been another long week of council meetings, but I'm glad to talk with you.
I've been picking up that the council finally voted on a budget.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess about Thursday afternoon, they gave final approval to the fiscal year 2021 budget, which obviously it's funding for the entire city apparatus, but the focus of that budget has been what's going to happen with the police department. And there's been a lot of proposals, which we've talked about, and now we kind of have a pretty clear picture. I think it's helpful to think about the police department budget, the proposed cuts by council, in really three different buckets. There's the immediate cuts, there's these kind of nearer term cuts that council is calling decoupling. There are functions that the police department currently does that will be decoupled from the department. And then the third bucket is kind of longer term, and council is referring to these as like reimagined safety fund.
Last year, the city budget was around $1 billion, and the police department was 430 some million. Do you remember what the grand total was for this year?
It was 434 million last year, which represents about 40% of the city's overall operating budget. This year, see, this is where it gets tricky. It could end up being $150 million less, which is about a 34% cut compared to the $434 million from last year. But the majority of those cuts are in the latter two buckets, the decoupling and the reimagine buckets, which are not guaranteed cuts. They are proposals that city staff is basically directed to execute. But there are all kinds of reasons to think that they may not happen. Really, the only cuts thus far that have actually happened and will take away money from the police department are the about $20 million in immediate cuts. That represents about 5% of the police department budget.
And we talked about that last week. A lot of that is the police academy, right?
Exactly. So basically, the council voted to cancel the cadet class in November and the two next year as well. And by doing that, there's these vacant officer positions that basically the department has funding for close to 200 police officers that they haven't filled. But by closing the police academy, there's no way to fill those positions. So it frees up that funding, which amounts to about $12, $13 million that can be reinvested in other social services, primarily EMS to help with their COVID response, Austin Public Health, housing programs for people experiencing homelessness, just a variety of social safety net type services. And so those are the, again, the immediate cuts, the only ones thus far that have been confirmed. The other ones are essentially ideas and policies that council is, by taking this vote, committing to accomplishing, but they're ideas that can't really be achieved as easily as canceling the academy classes. Just to kind of give a couple of examples, One of the functions that could be decoupled from the police department is the DNA lab, the forensics lab, where scientists who work for the police department analyze forensic evidence in laboratories, you know, collected by officers and detectives in criminal cases. It's long been an expert opinion from, you know, researchers that these kinds of labs should be operated independently from police departments. And so this is an idea that police officials support, and it's an idea that advocates and city council members support. There's consensus on this. So if the police department is no longer going to run the lab, who's going to do it? Should it be a joint partnership with Travis County? Should it be kind of a what's called a local government corporation like the Sobering Center? Should it just be kind of its own independent entity? These are the questions that staff, advocates, and council and police officials are going to work together over the coming months to figure out what is the best solution to remove this function from the police department. That's one of the decoupling cuts, which that bucket in total represents about $80 million in additional police department funding reductions.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why that's something that can't flip a switch and then take that money out of APD. You got to figure out how you actually do it practically.
So we had about $20 million that was just a raw cut. And here we are in the repurposing. We're already at about $80 million here. So we're up to about $100 million off. There are a few other things that could be decoupled as well, right?
Yeah, totally. So another one that I think will be a little more controversial, or probably a lot more controversial, but would really strike a major victory for advocates of police accountability, is to take the Internal Affairs Division, which is tasked with conducting investigations into alleged officer misconduct, and make it some kind of independent entity. There's long been a history of a flawed accountability system in policing. And really, there are a number of reasons that police officers are difficult to hold accountable for their misconduct. But this is one thing that advocates point to, is that essentially cops are investigating cops, and that's something that this could change. But there are legal questions associated with that. Is it legal under state law for civilians to investigate sworn officers? That may not be the case. Maybe it needs to be a joint operation with some civilian investigators and leadership and some sworn investigators and leaders. So that's another thing that staff, police, advocates, and so on will kind of work together over the next few months into next year to figure out how to accomplish this decoupling. And then the last bucket is really functions that may take even longer to figure out. Those are the reimagined safety funds. They represent about $49 million in additional cuts. And I think one good example to pull out from there is traffic enforcement. So this is something that we're learning, not just in Austin, but in police departments across the country. Police officers spend a lot of their time essentially managing traffic, whether it be issuing speeding tickets or helping out at a collision. And so these are functions that advocates and on council think other civilian city staff can handle. The employees would be less expensive than a police officer to handle these kinds of tasks. But there are all kinds of operational and legal questions surrounding an idea like that. So it's something that could happen, but really there needs to be much more exploration into how it would be executed before that funding and that function can be taken away from a police department.
And another one that I hear all the time is the homeless. Would that be in this reimagine, or is that part of the previous category?
Really, it's probably somewhere like around all three of them. When a 911 call comes in for someone who is passed out on the street or appears to be, you know, in need of medical attention on a sidewalk or something, a police officer is usually the first person to respond to that scene. What council in the city really wants to do is change who responds to those calls. EMS has a program called Community Health Paramedics, and this is a really amazing group of individuals who do a lot of outreach work to not just people experiencing homelessness, but people with severe disabilities, people living in extreme poverty. They do almost like case management work. They help them get driver's license, and they help them fill medical prescriptions, in addition to providing harm reduction type medical care. So what council hopes is, by growing the size of the community health paramedic team, they can start responding to more of these calls involving unhoused individuals instead of the police. In addition to some of the money that's being taken away from the police department, some of that $20 million is going to be invested into housing programs and healthcare programs that can help people experiencing homelessness.
Well, so you got the three buckets here, and what's the grand total of the amount that's kind of on the table for reduction for the APD budget?
So it's $150 million in total. It's $20 million for the immediate cuts, $80 for the decoupling, and then $49 for the Reimagine Fund, which, yeah, again, is $150 million, which does amount to about 34% of the police department's budget compared to last year. I think when people hear that, they think that the ability for the city to provide public safety is reduced by a third, which is not really the case. It's important to understand what the city and what council is trying to achieve with this kind of buzz phrase, reimagining public safety. Again, thinking back to what I was just explaining with homeless individuals, it's about providing public safety through different means. Historically, Austin and every other city in America has relied on the police to provide way more service than they are trained or equipped to handle. And so this proposal really takes the first step toward reimagining that status quo and finding different ways of helping people, really primarily from needing police officers. So it's a very ambitious idea, but there's certainly research supporting this transition, but it just requires a really fundamental shift in how city dollars are invested and really how the culture responds to some things that may be public nuisances, like a person experiencing homelessness who is sleeping on a sidewalk. That may be a public nuisance, but it's not really a public safety threat. That's really the work that council is embarking on. I've already seen some of the groups that are sympathetic to the police department were suggesting that the council cut 150 police officer positions, but that's a little misleading because it sort of sounds like they voted to lay off police officers, which is not the case. That was never on the table. Some advocacy groups absolutely wanted council to do that, but there was very little appetite among council members to do anything like that. I've heard countless times from basically every council member and the mayor that they would not vote for a budget that would lead to the scenario where a 911 call goes unanswered. And they say that what they voted on will not lead to that. Chief Manley has been kind of making the media rounds starting yesterday saying that will not happen. So yeah, I think it's important to point that out.
Do we have any reaction or any response from AJC or other activist organizations?
The Austin Justice Coalition and Just Liberty, I would say, are a little more satisfied with the vote. They are applauding council and recognize the accomplishment of cutting at least $20 million with a plan to cut another $130 million or so. Those two groups were calling for about $100 million in cuts. So it's in line with what they were calling for. But then on the other side of it, we have grassroots leadership and another group called Communities of Color United. And they have been calling for $220 million in cuts. So they've been a little bit more vocal about the budget council adopted Thursday as really not being anywhere near enough. Although, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that $100 million is difficult to get to without laying off any police officers. $220 million is pretty much impossible. So when you kind of consider that, there was really no way that $220 million would be achieved in one budget cycle. But one thing that all groups are unified in is the work doesn't end now.
I think you could fairly say that city council has been somewhat responsive.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair to say. And the fact that this was a unanimous vote really suggests that. And I think it's important to consider the history. For the past, I think, at least 6 years, every budget cycle, the police department's budget has increased. So not only is this the first year that the budget for policing did not increase, it's a significant decrease. Certainly for activists and advocates, they have to keep pushing, right? That's what they do. They have to keep saying, this isn't enough. What council voted on is a response to these demands, even if it isn't sufficient for some of the groups and some of the individuals who've been advocating.
We've been talking about this for several weeks. You've been right on top of it. So on behalf of our listeners, many, many thanks.
Well, I appreciate that. It's been intense work covering the story, but I'm glad to write about it and then talk with you and your listeners about it.
Thanks, and we'll get you back on here again soon.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks again.
That's all for this evening. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening and stay safe, everyone.